Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. So we're in the library section, and the next library in order is libedit. That's the first one in the E section of the libraries. And I'm going to try to really get through a bunch again, just like in the previous episode, because I'm really trying to get through this library section. It is tough. So libedit is a library from NetBSD that provides command line editing capabilities and functions, similar to what GNU Readline provides. That's kind of how it's described, like GNU Readline. Of course, the problem with describing something by comparing it to something else is that you have to be familiar with that something else in order for that to mean anything for you. Foo, it's like bar. Well, what's bar? Well, if you don't know what bar is, you don't know what foo is. So you can read all about GNU Readline by doing man space 3 space readline, and you get a lot of information about readline from that. You could also just do info readline, which gives you even more information, lots of great information, and I think a very natural kind of easy way of reading it. It's much more like a manual. I've gotten, it's neither here nor there, but I have really gotten fond of info pages lately. I just find them so darned easy to use. They're so well written. I mean, not universally well written, but I mean, a lot of them are really well written. They're written, as I say, more like an article or a book rather than just a dump of options without really any context. So info pages, I have started almost defaulting to them. Not always. I mean, there are some times where I don't bother because maybe I know the command really, really well already, and really all I need is that quick reminder. And that's when the man page comes in handy sometimes, or just the dash dash help. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. As I said, libedit, it is like GNU Readline. If you don't know what GNU Readline is, and you can't be bothered to read the documentation, which there's a lot of it, so I wouldn't blame you. The way to describe it is simply, like, when you're using a terminal, the fact that you can, for instance, I don't know, hit delete to remove a character behind you. Like, not delete, what's this, backspace? Backspace. The fact that you could type something, let's do, like, I don't know, find dot dash type f dash I name. Oh wait, I misspelled find. I want to go back to the beginning of the line. Well, how do you do that? How do you get back to the beginning of a line in a terminal? It's not like a text editor. You can't just click and be there, right? Well, Control A sends you to the back, to the start of your command, and then you can either hit the delete key, the forward delete key, or the Control D to delete and erase what you have, find, and spell it correctly. Or maybe, let's say you had typed FNID instead of find, FFNID. So you could go Control FF to the I position, and then hit Control T to swap the I with its preceding character, thereby swapping the I and the N, and now you're left with find. Control E gets you to the end of the line. All of that stuff, if that's news to you, that's really maybe intermediate to advanced Emacs key bindings. All of those are provided to you through GNU Readline. The fact that you can do that kind of editing of a command, well, that you can edit a command, that you don't have to just cancel out, Control C, start typing again at the beginning of the line, that's provided by, in this case, GNU Readline. Now, libedit provides similar functionality. I don't know what off the top of my head uses libedit instead of GNU Readline. I would have to do LDD on a bunch of applications to find one. I guess we could do, like, let's just really quick try TCSH. Where's my TCSH? TCSH. Do I not have TCSH installed? Yes, of course I do. I just don't know where it is. Okay, which TCSH? Oh, it's in bin. I probably should have known that. Okay, TCSH, LDD, no, that doesn't use libedit either. So I don't know what uses libedit, don't know. But it's a library, and if you want to write something with like a terminal emulator or something with editing functionality, you could use libedit. Libevent is next, and it is a, we might be through the E section now, and it's an event, well, it's an API providing event, a callback function, so that when a specific event occurs on a file descriptor, then something else can happen. And that's an important feature if you need to be notified that your command has been completed, or, well, that's the only example I can think of, really. Well, no, that's not, like, and if, or if you want something to happen, like a, something occurs on a file descriptor, or there's a timeout on an operation, you know, some operation, then maybe you want to, you need to detect that, so that your application can then move on to the next stage. So, like in programming, a lot of times, I mean, very frequently in programming, your code is just sitting there waiting for something to happen. If you think about like a GUI application, in fact, that's practically all it does. I mean, the fact that a window stays open after you launch an application, That's because it's just waiting for events to happen. I've just opened up a text editor and it's just sitting there. It's not going to close itself. It is listening for an event that might signal it to close, but it's also listening for an event that tells it that I want to type some stuff in, or that I want to save my work, or that I want to close that tab and discard, and then file quit. So those are all events, and libevent is a file, or rather an event notification library. It can shuttle a notification about an event, like a signal around. In fact, that's what Qt, for instance, it doesn't, I don't think it uses libevent, but Qt, as far as I know, it does not use libevent. Qt has a whole system called signals and slots, and it is, that's the whole infrastructure of that is just, you know, like the feature there is that, yes, you can listen for an event, and when an event happens, whether it happens now, 30 seconds from now, or 4 hours from now, when it happens, you can trigger something else to happen. Very important in principle. Libevent is a library that provides that. Libexif, E-X-I-F. I think we've kind of talked about this, right? This is the exchangeable image file format library. There is the ability to put metadata into files, and in graphic files, the metadata subsystem is called EXIF, exchangeable image file format. And this is a library that, just like so many other libraries, I'm trying to think of the one that I was talking about, I think just last week or maybe the week before, but I can't remember what it was. Was it async.io or something, or no? Anyway, libraries. It's useful to have that library because now you don't have to write the code to look at the certain spot in a file that should have, that could have EXIF data in it. And then you don't have to extract that EXIF data manually. I mean, you still do with libexif. You have to tell libexif to do it. And there's a function for that to, okay, retrieve the data, put it into an array or something, I imagine. I haven't looked at libexif myself, but you probably put it into an array, and then you can parse that array. You can say, or a dictionary, you know, whatever, what it's called, a map. Get that information, find out what the key and the values are, cycle through that, present it to the user, or process it yourself. Maybe you need to see, well, what's the orientation of this graphic, or what's the lens type of this graphic? Maybe you want to trigger lens fun to then correct something in a graphic by automatically detecting the lens type as reported by EXIF. Not that I know that EXIF data actually has that information. I think it does. Certainly would have camera information, like camera make and model. So I guess if nothing else, you could narrow it down. Okay, next up is, oh yeah, and yes, we are indeed out of the E section now. So that was E, we're already through it. We're in F now. Libfake Key. This is a virtual keyboard library. So if you are working on one of those keyboards that pops up on screen, that you would then click the keys with your mouse or touch screen if you've got touch screen, this is a library for that. This seems to come from something called the Matchbox Window Manager, which I'd never heard of before, which honestly surprises me. I tend to sort of, I don't know, like, doesn't everyone sort of watch window managers, see what's coming, what's going, where everything is? I'd never heard of this before, but it exists. You can go to github.com/netplc/matchbox-window-manager. That's netplc, net Papa Lima Charlie, matchbox-window-manager. This is obviously just the lib fake key from this project, apparently. And I don't know sort of the status of Matchbox Window Manager. Certainly, they refer to a website called projects.o-band.com/matchbox. And if you try to go to that website, it does not know, it cannot find that website. The internet does not know about that. So I don't know. I don't know what Matchbox was or is. You can apparently, build it. I may try building it sometime soon and just see. I mean, heck, maybe over the coffee break. I don't know. See what sort of what it does. Although you do apparently need lib Matchbox before building, and it doesn't necessarily say where you get lib Matchbox from. Hopefully somewhere else in this repository. Not really sure. So anyway, there's Matchbox-keyboard in that. So actually, I guess the better place to go would be github.com/netplc/matchbox-keyboard. That seems to be really what you would want to look at if you were going to use lib key a fake key. And it's, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It seems like an interesting project. This does look like it hasn't been touched in a while. I get that weird feeling that maybe this isn't a super, sort of active project, but I don't know. It is kind of intriguing. And certainly if you wanted to pick up development on this, or you had some related thing where you were just thinking, oh, I really want just a pop-up keyboard real quick so I could have my users type in a PIN or something, then maybe this would be useful. Who knows? Libfake key. All right, next up is libffi. That's the foreign function interface library. So foreign function interface, that's an interface that allows code written in one language to call code written in another language. This is very, very cool. Something I hope one day, maybe before I die, I will understand this kind of stuff. I mean, this stuff is like magic to me. This is so cool. So libffi provides a really like base or like a they say that I always get this confused. They say it's a high-level programming interface, but see, I think of that as low-level. But anyway, what it provides is the components you need to call code from one language into another. So, for instance, C Python. You can write a C function and then call it from Python as if though, more or less, as if though it was C code. It's a little bit more complex than that. They make it sound so easy. But libffi makes it sort of easy for the Python developers to make that relatively easy for you, the Python developer. Well, also the C developer. OpenJDK, Java, that uses libffi to bridge between the interpreter and native code for some platforms. I don't know which, the website doesn't say. There's Java Native Access, JNA, that uses libffi. Ruby FFI uses FFI for Ruby, and there's something related like Ruby Coco. I mean, I don't know how related that is, but it also uses libffi apparently to be able to call Objective-C code from your Ruby project, and on, a bunch of different ones. Racket, that's a Lisp Or no, it's sorry, it's not Lisp, it's Scheme, and you can call C code from within there. Even GCJ, which is the GNU compiler for Java, uses libffi to handle calls back and forth between the interpreted part of Java and the compiled part of a Java project. Oh my gosh, we're through the F section now. We're in the G's. This is great. This is progress. Okay. Libglade is the next one. Libglade is it doesn't actually sort of exactly refer to Glade, the IDE, the GNOME desktop IDE, or GDK slash GNOME IDE. It's really talking about the ability that certainly Glade provides, the IDE provides, the ability to create user interfaces for applications in a way that your interface and your code, like the application, I guess the, what do they call it? The business code or whatever they call it. What do they call that? Business programming? Business? I don't know. Whatever. The stuff that your application actually does, you can build the application code and the interface itself separately. Which could be a big deal, because it could mean, for instance, well, it certainly means that you're not fiddling around with like window layout and where a field is going to go, you know, in the file where you're also doing, I don't know, complex matrix transforms or something. It separates essentially sort of content from style, which is really, really important for a lot of different reasons. I mean, one is because you could have, in theory, someone working on the design of the application while someone else works on the code, and they're not working like they're not trying to struggle with like the same file and so on. So that's a great thing. You could have just you could just be cleaner for the programmer as well, you know, like it can get pretty distracting to have like all your silly laborious design work in the same place as like the real stuff that the application does. So, and I think the design of the interface is it is shockingly tedious in reality. Like it takes a lot of work to do that, and a lot of revisions too, because you think you know what makes sense, and then you build it and you look at it and you think, oh, that doesn't actually make sense. It need that button should be over here. That field shouldn't even show up yet. You know, all these other revisions, and you're going into the main part of your code to copy and paste lines and cut and paste, and it can get messy and confusing and a little bit noisy. So libglade helps you separate those two things out. And then when you compile your code, you use libglade to sort of connect the application code to the interface code, which is written generally in XML. Now, I personally, I just keep thinking, like, surely everything could actually just use HTML and CSS, because in my mind, HTML and CSS is just, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing for structuring dynamic interfaces. Like I feel like it's tried, true and tested. You know, like I mean that people are doing that like every day on the internet, and people are consuming these interfaces on all kinds of different devices. Like if you want something that's been stress tested, I feel like HTML and CSS have been pretty well stress tested. Like if you want dynamic interfaces, I feel like that's kind of where to look. I know Qt does have some ability to sort of provide a CSS override for some of its interface components. I don't know what GTK slash GNOME does for that, although I do know there's a really cool thing where with GTK, you can launch an interface, I think, in a web browser. I forget how you do this, but it's probably due to like updates to libglade. I don't know if this is for version 2.4 or something. The documentation's really good, and that's in user share gtk-doc/html/libglade/index.html. This is for libglade 2.6.4. So I don't know, you know, I'm imagining this as progressed in very recent years quite a lot. But there are some really good examples of how this works, and it talks about Glade XML and what you can what functions you can call from that and what widget functions you have available. It's a pretty cool system. And Glade, the IDE, from what I understand, I don't really use it myself, makes it sort of easy to interface with, well, to interface to use that system in your code. So I guess take a look at it if you're doing GTK development. I don't know that Slackware is the best platform for GTK development. Probably something like Fedora or I don't know, whatever else is out there that's kind of bleeding edge might be the thing to do that on. I mean, yeah, and bleeding edge and very GTK centric. All right, next up is libgnome-keyring. That's the GNOME keyring library. This is your authentication and any kind of user secrets that GNOME needs to authenticate you quickly into various systems. That on the GNOME desktop, for instance, that might include something like connecting your online accounts with your desktop. And I have to do that at work. I have to connect a couple of different online accounts, or I don't have to, but I'm able to the GNOME desktop, and then you get things for free, and as far as you can recall, you haven't even signed in. It just magically happens. So that's that kind of thing is possible because of the GNOME keyring. This is the library to access that keyring as a developer. So in other words, this is a lot like what is it? Kwallet, KDE wallet, whatever we call it now. But again, this is the library for developers to interface with that. Let's talk about libgnt. This is the glib incurses toolkit. Incurses is a really fun way of building really, really basic user interfaces. So if you've ever used SBOPKG, the Slack build installer, originally written by Chess Griffin and I think maintained now by the slackbuild.org team, if you've ever used that, then hey, you've experienced incurses. Well, if you've ever used it in its interactive mode, if you've ever used like package tool or the Slackware installer, then you've experienced incurses. So it just draws big blocks of pixels on your screen to mimic, essentially like an 8-bit computer system. Like it's just really sort of raw pixels on in a frame buffer, and it uses that. The cool thing is that it has constructs. It has little objects already defined in the library, so that you, as a developer, you could say, okay, I want there to be a quote unquote button, and it will create like what sort of looks like a button out of sort of pixel art almost. I mean, it's even less than, maybe it's just a big block, just a colored block with the word okay or cancel in it, and the user can arrow from one or the other and press return, and that triggers some action, or they can scroll through a menu and the next menu highlights, and then the next menu item highlights, and then the next one. They can click a button, or rather, they can press a key, and they're clicking that menu item, and then it goes to the next screen or whatever. And I, you can use that for a lot of different. You can draw interface conventions like windows and buttons, but you can also, use it just as a library to enable people to use to have an interactive session with a terminal. And I say interactive as opposed to non-interactive, meaning that usually you just type a command, hit return, and that's the computer does the thing that you have told it to do. That's not interactive. That there has been an interaction. You've commanded, the computer has followed the command, but it's not it doesn't have that sort of time together, that idle time. Lib incurse or incurses rather, kind of kicks it into an event cycle. It presents a menu or a window or an interface of some kind and waits for input. So libgnt provides that through this project, which was originally the Finch project, which I don't know all of the relations, but Finch was somehow related to Pigeon or adjacent to Pigeon, or maybe it's the other way around. And then from that general project, there was libpurple, which was the very back end for chat applications. You want to write a chat application and be able to parse, you know, in ingest and send all kinds of different chat protocols like Jabber and that's the only one I can remember right now. Jabber. I'm sure there are other chat protocols these days. There must be some, but like all that stuff, libpurple may be able to do that for you. So all of those things are sort of wrapped up together. Finch and libpurple. I guess they must have written probably a terminal-based front end, which again, that kind of thing is possible because of these modular libraries. You can have an application that the actual workhorse portion of your application can be running in code over here. Your interface can be joined up to it separately. They don't have to be locked together. So you've got libpurple that can just input and output all kinds of chat protocols, and then you grab glib incurses toolkit libgnt and write up a quick interface for, maybe not quick, but you write up an interface for this chat application, and now suddenly you've got a chat application with the power of WeChat or XChat or whatever else is out there these days. But it's running in a terminal, and it's an interactive session. So your user doesn't have to like keep typing in programs until they get a new message. You know, like it's just there. It's running in their terminal interactively, and that's why this modularity is so powerful. You know, you got all these libraries doing all these different jobs, and you tether them together. And yeah, you know, a lot of times it's not so modular that you just point at something and it launches. You do have to compile things so that they know that the other thing exists and so on. But that's the modular dream right there, is that you can have those separate components. Okay, maybe it's not the modular dream, but it's a great start to true modularity. You have all these different components, you tie them together, yes, at compile time, but during development, they are separate. They can be developed separately, they can be done by different teams, or they just help you focus on what you actually have to do, keep your code cleaner, and then you tie them together at compile time, and suddenly you have some project that has a lot more power than it sort of deserves to have in a way. So anyway, that's libgnt, I guess. It's probably time for coffee, so let's go get some, and then we'll come back and talk about libgphoto2. And I'm back with coffee. The coffee's getting a little bit better. The deeper down this container I get, the better and better the coffee becomes. I don't know if I'm just acclimating to it and I just feel like it's fine now, or whether I am actually working my way through the different layers of the different coffee roasts that I ended up with. I'm not sure which it is. Once it gets about halfway down, I think I might just shake up the container to try to distribute all the flavor evenly through the container, and hopefully have some halfway decent cups of coffee for the next couple of weeks. But we'll see. And I, of course, will keep you updated on that situation. But for now, I think we have a couple of rapid fire libraries that we can just kind of power through. The first one is simple enough. It's libgphoto2. We've talked about gphoto2. It was back in episode 357, so that's probably about 100 and, 200 episodes ago, less than 200, but nearly 200 episodes ago. That's really weird to think about, actually. This is, what, 536? That was 357, so, like, what's that, like, around 180, something like that? Wow, that's really crazy. So anyway, yeah, 180 episodes ago, just 180, I guess, functionally, hours ago, well, not hours, 180 hours of content ago, we talked about G Photo 2. There you go. So that's it's a G Photo itself is a command, or G Photo 2, whatever, is a command that allows you to query a digital camera that's attached to your computer, or a digital imaging device attached to your computer. You can find out what photographs it has on its internal storage. You can acquire those photographs over the MTP protocol, and so on. libgphoto2 is the library that does all of those things. And so if you look at the header files in user include gphoto or something like that, then you see all the header files, a huge list of all the camera manufacturers. And then if you go into the header files or into the documentation, you can look at that in like Firefox. It's in, again, user doc, gphoto-doc or something like that. And you can review it. You can look through it. I looked through it all, and it's got function names and things in there that make sense, you know, like list capabilities, JPEG parsing, all the things that you would expect, I guess, a digital imaging interface to provide. So if you were going to write your own application that needed access to a camera, you might use libgphoto. Like if you were to do like a security camera type software where you wanted to be able to take a picture every couple of, actually, does gphoto do that? Maybe not. If you wanted to write an application to, I guess, drag photos off of the camera, you could do that. Now, of course, these days it's not just cameras that have images on them. So libgphoto2 provides for photos, but also for music, audio files. And there's a function to determine whether it's an imaging device or an audio playback device. So it can tell the difference. And that's important, because most everyone nowadays has a device that does both. It can play audio, it can do images. That the combination of that sort of interface makes sense. Now, there is a similar library, libgpod, and that's the next in the list. Oh, I just realized I skipped libgnt. Okay, well, hold on. So libgpod, formerly of the GTK Pod application, which, as memory serves, was a pleasantly minimalist or simplistic application where you would plug in your iPod at the time, or similar device, and GTK Pod could detect it and synchronize the little database that the iPods used to do. It was a horrible, horrible interface, or a horrible way to access the device. I mean, there was no good way to interact with an Apple branded iPod. It was always a miserable experience, and the people behind these projects like libgpod and even libphoto, I mean, they were doing such a service to humanity by doing all of that work, decoding all of the weird ways the iPod had to keep track of all of the files on it. I shouldn't say had to, chose to. And anyway, you could add and remove music from an iPod through GTK Pod. Well, at one point it became clear to them that it just made sense not to have, again, we're talking about modularity here, not to have that UI and the functions of just discovering and interacting with an iPod. Why did those share the same code base? So they broke it out and they made libgpod. Today, I don't know how useful libgpod is. It may yet be useful. I don't know. I don't know if like modern iPhones are, I don't think that they are, that they use libgpod. So I think that's lib iPhone, I think. So I don't think gpod is useful that way. But I mean, if you are someone who still has an iPod, then this could be useful. And I think that's the important thing to realize here, is that this is open source software, and in this world, you can have an iPod from 2000 and, I don't know, whenever they came out, like 2002, 2003, whatever, and it will still work on your Linux computer through open source software. Now, the same may be true. I don't know. You may have an iPod from 2003, and you might be able to plug it into a Windows or a Mac machine, and maybe it works just as well. I don't know. I haven't tried. I haven't talked to anyone within in that situation, but at least there's the assurance that here in the open source world, that will continue to work really for as long as someone continues to maintain maintain libgpod or libgphoto too, and bundle it into or make it available to your Linux distribution. That's huge. I think that's a really big deal because, I mean, you talk about sort of the problems of rampant consumerism and just kind of disposable culture, and it just kind of warms the heart to know that open source software at least makes it possible for people to reasonably not just toss out that device that they have. I mean, and it's a little bit weird, I guess, because, I mean, if you do have a mobile phone, like, do you really need that iPod device anymore, that media player? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I know people who use the media players. I was using media players until, I guess, maybe the pandemic. Or no, maybe since moving to Lawrence, actually, because now I'm just kind of, I work from home, I'm home a lot. It just kind of makes sense to just play media off of computers or off of a mobile phone. And the media player, the portability of that became less important. But I was using a media player up until, you know, relatively recently, I guess. And I would go back to one if the need arose. Okay, let's talk about libgnt. I have to refresh my memory about what this is real quick. Libgnt, oh yeah, that's, we did talk about that. Okay, that was the glib incurses. So next up is libgsf, and this is the, I just tried to download it instead of read the description. Libgsf is the structured file in and out library. So libgsf provides in out IO abstraction for dealing with, quote, and this is straight off their website, quote, different structured file formats. I don't really ever know what that means when people say things like that, but I mean, I guess by different they mean various, and by various they mean .doc and .xxsl. Is that whatever Excel spreadsheets are? XLS? Yeah, probably Excel spreadsheet. Yeah, XLS. So libgsf can extract data from common office formats, and from what I can tell, it's used primarily by Gnumeric, which is a open source spreadsheet application, a little bit like AbbeyWord, I guess, if AbbeyWord is even still around. I mean, I know technically it's still around. I haven't really kept up with its actual development. Like, how well is it, like, really, does it work still or no? I don't even know. Haven't really tried it lately. It's so useful, AbbeyWord, but I do kind of wonder whether it's something that people are using these days. Yeah, I can't tell from its SourceForge page how active it is right now. I mean, it says last update was 2013. But, I mean, it could just be somewhere else. I don't know. Anyway, point is, AbbeyWord and Gnumeric, they were kind of the lightweight versions of sort of LibreOffice, really. So you had AbbeyWord as a pleasantly simplistic word processor, and Gnumeric as, I think, a fairly robust but still, you know, pretty lightweight. And by lightweight, I mean it was using, you know, it's programmed in probably C and using GTK libraries for its front end. So it feels very native, whereas, of course, LibreOffice is just, it's Java and probably, I don't know, C and stuff, you know, just a bunch of, it's got a bunch of additional things sort of baked into it. And so it doesn't feel quite as snappy. There's a lot of different components. It's a big project. Gnumeric was just a spreadsheet. AbbeyWord is just a word processor. And so it was often seen as kind of like the quote-unquote lightweight alternative to a full-on Office suite. LibGSF was used by Gnumeric to import data that someone might have embedded, as it were, in some other Office format. I mean, really, a Microsoft Office format. So you've got Excel data and documents. And I saw in one of their comments on their repository that they're also trying to extract sort of table data from like PowerPoint presentations and stuff. So they really want to be able to just like get that data, parse it into something interchangeable, and then enable some application to use that. Now, there is also, in addition to the library itself, a command, GSF. So that is, if you do a man GSF, or is it, yeah, man GSF, you can look at that command, and that is one of the three binaries that ships with this library. So there's GSF, there's GSF-office thumbnailer, and then GSF-VBA-dump. VBA being the, I think, Visual Basic something or another, which I know nothing about, so I can't even begin to comment really on it. I know it's a big deal for like Office, Microsoft Office stuff, because I think that's, as I understand it, that's how they do all of their scripting and stuff. So I guess that's quite important, especially for really, really interactive spreadsheets. I think being able to understand what someone's trying to do in VBA, and then, you know, I don't know, potentially re-implementing it in some kind of open source scripting functionality within a spreadsheet would be pretty nice. So the GSF command is a simple archive utility similar to tar. It operates on files following one of the structured file formats understood by the G structured file library. That is GSF library, lib GSF. For example, Microsoft Excel files. So you can kind of see some of it. I mean, I've never used this tool before, but you can kind of see some of the functionality if you just go to like LibreOffice or something where you can create an Excel file in. Go to like, I'll just open up an existing spreadsheet. Here's an ODS file, so that's the LibreOffice format. But then I'll go to File, I'll save it as an XLS file instead. Click save. It warns you that you're about to use a Microsoft format, and whether you asks whether you'd rather use the LibreOffice format, but in this case I actually want to use the Excel format. And so now I've got an Excel file. Now I happen to know that this spreadsheet has one sheet, like one tab. You know how in a spreadsheet you can have like lots of different sort of tables or spreadsheets, whatever they're called, like tabs. This one only has one. So I'm going to do a GSF list and then example.xls, and it shows me what I've got. So D0 root, I'm assuming that's the directory, like the archive itself. And then F, O-L-E, I don't know what that means. F, again, comp obj, like computation object maybe. And then here's one that looks somewhat familiar. F, workbook. F, summary information. F, document summary information. So that seems like probably what I'm seeing there is the spreadsheet itself. The workbook, I imagine, would be the workbook. Now, to dump the workbook, you can do a GSF dump workbook, and where are we doing that from? Example.xls, and it says it failed to do that. Did I get that mixed up? Yes, I did. I got those two arguments reversed. Okay, there we go. GSF dump example.xls, and then space workbook with all the correct capitalization. And in this case, it looks like it's just an init cap. So capital W, lowercase ORKBOOK. And there we go. There's the workbook in beautiful, beautiful hex. So it just dumps it as hex code into your terminal. But I mean, it's got the sort of the decoded sort of view of the data over on the right hand column. It's just like hex dump. So, or is that what it's called? Hex dump? Yeah, hex dump, or hex dump dash dash canonical, really, I think. So you can kind of see the data, get a feel for what it is. How useful is this? I don't know. I mean, you know, this is the kind of data. I mean, it's extracted the data. What you do with that is up to you. So that's the GSF command. Probably not a great, truly a great demonstration, because like I said, I've never actually used it before, and I very, very rarely use Excel spreadsheets. I use ODS spreadsheets on occasion. So I'm going to make a second tab here. So at the bottom of LibreOffice, I'm just going to hit the plus sign next to the tab name. That provides a new sheet 2 is what it's called. And I'll just put in foo bar bar baz gnu world order. Okay, so I've got some cells with some data in it. And now once again, I'm going to go to save as. I'm going to save this as a XLS. It's Excel 97 through 2003, apparently. Rename it. I don't know why it doesn't change the... Oh, automatic file name extension. That's why. Okay. Replace. Yes, replace. Yes, use the Excel format. Close that document. All right, so I'm going to go back to my terminal and do another GSF list example.xls. And ooh, boy, I don't see my other workbook, to be honest. I see that the workbook contains more data. So I guess the workbook is always the workbook, even if there are several tabs in it. But the count, the data count has gone up. Previously, it was 2689 workbook, and then it was 33. Right now, it is 3310 workbook. So if I do and dump again, I should see even more data, and I definitely do. So there you go. Like I say, what you do with that data is up to you. It's a library. It's a command. You would know, I guess, if you needed it. Next up is GTOP, or rather libgtop, and that's a library to fetch information about the running system. So it's a lot like top, just the top command, except it is written, it's a library, and as you might guess from the G prefix, it is written with GNOME in mind, and I think the source code is maintained over on the GNOME GitLab website, the instance. And the point is that it's going to give you top-like information, but it's in formats that you could then integrate into some kind of system monitor, a graphical system monitor. I would imagine that on the GNOME desktop, if you were to open up whatever they use for, like as a task monitor or a process monitor, whatever they use for that, I would imagine, I would be shocked if it didn't use libgtop. Whether or what on Slackware uses libgtop, I don't know. I'm really not sure, but there it is, libgtop. Okay, libical, it's an open source MPL or LGPL implementation of the IETF's iCalendar calendaring and scheduling protocols. Those are RFC 2445, 2446, 2447. It parses iCal components and provides C, C++, Python, and Java APIs for whatever you need to do. This is huge. Go to github.com/libical to see all of it in its full glory. But I mean, really, this is kind of huge. This is one of those things that if you want to parse iCal data, which is very widely used. I mean, I would say it was the default calendaring protocol, which I guess is lucky. I mean, we have an open source implementation of it. I think iCal, for me personally, I feel like there's a little bit of I feel like it's problematic because there are just so many clients out there that do iCal, and not all of them are great. And I would say the most popular one isn't that great. So it's the most popular being Google Calendar, or at least that's the one that I come across the most. So I find it unpleasant. I do not love the experience of iCal, but then again, I don't love the experience of calendaring at all. Scheduling is just not something that I love to do. I find it tedious, find it a little bit stressful. Like, I don't like to plan that far ahead, even though you really kind of have to when you're an adult. So I don't know. I think it's good that we have the protocol, and I certainly appreciate having the ability to create appointments that then other authenticated people can modify and interact with. Like, that kind of functionality is, granted, really important, and it has changed the way we schedule and coordinate with one another. Is it for the better? I don't know. I still have a hard time coordinating with people. Granted, I'm 12 or 13 hours offset of UTC, which is very drastic, and so that alone becomes complex. I don't know. Scheduling is just a horrible, horrible part of being a human, I guess, in the modern world. We have to do it. It's something you got to do. I don't enjoy it. iCal, in theory, should make it better, easier, more fun. And in practice, I'm just not convinced that I don't think it's gotten there. But I don't know a better answer either. So really, everything I'm saying is pointless. LibiCal does a great job. I mean, it's the thing is going to let you interface with, I keep saying interface, but, you know, interact with data, with iCal data. Do you want to? I don't know. I mean, maybe you do. If you're writing a calendaring application, then I guess you would want to do that. I would assume that Contact is probably using, can we find out? User, where does Contact live? I don't even know which Contact user bin. All right, so if I do an LDD on user bin contact and then do a grep-i for libical. No, amazingly, it's not apparently using. That doesn't make any sense, but that's what it says. Maybe there's some other component within contact that uses libical. I guess I could do like a find in user bin type F. There's probably a better thing to search for than F, but I can't be bothered to look that up right now. Type F, and then we'll do a exec grep dash capital H lowercase I. Oh wait, no, we have to do a LDD for curly brace and then pipe. No, wait, that's not going to work either, because if I do that, I'm just grepping standard input, so I will never know what has hit. So I need to do this just as a for loop, pretty much. So for I in slash user slash bin slash star semicolon do echo $i. That way I get the name of the program. There's probably a better way to do that so that I'm only echoing the successes, but whatever. And so ampersand LDD space $i. Let's redirect errors to greater than symbol slash dev slash null pipe grep dash lowercase I. I don't need the H because I'm echoing libical. I guess could I put the echo there so that if I get a hit, I echo? Let's do that, maybe. I don't know if that'll work. Do echo, so ampersand there instead. Echo $i semicolon done. And oh, that did work. That worked very well. Okay, so it wasn't contact, it was Akinadi. Akinadi underscore archive mail agent, libical. Akinadi birthdays resource, libical. Akinadi console, libical. It's all over Akinadi. Akinadi. Calendar janitor, I think I remember seeing that in contact, I think. Is that right? There's more. There's itinerary, k-alarm, k-mail, console calendar. Forgot about that one. K-time tracker, inbox importer. Yeah, so the KDE personal information suite definitely uses this library. Now we know. And that's a good command to keep in mind. I should be doing that for all the libraries. Let's go back to the beginning and I'll do that. No, I'm just kidding. libid3 tag. Well, we've talked about ID3 and metadata in several other places. Things like talking about KID3, I think. Yeah, for sure, in the KDE. I think we've talked about easy tag. I think we've just talked about IDV2, or rather ID3V2, the command. So yeah, it's metadata. It's for ID3 tags specifically are for MP3s, maybe MP4s as well, but not, interestingly, not really for OGG. OGG uses its own metadata style, if I recall correctly. No, for sure it does. Yeah. It implements it differently, for instance. Now, a lot of the taggers that you see on Linux can also do OGG, and they don't necessarily differentiate, like, hey, this isn't an ID3 tag anymore, which I think arguably is a good thing. I kind of don't care. Although I guess also I do care because if all the tags that you're tagging look like ID3 to you as the user, then if you try to use the ID3 command on them, then something might not work. But in either way, that's ID3. What am I doing? Lib ID3 tag, right? So I'm just doing an LDD really quick. Lib ID3 tag. So the thing that uses this actually is EasyTag. And EasyTag is a great application. I use it a lot. I was using it a lot for a while when I was tagging a bunch of stuff. It just kind of, I don't know, it just was kind of working for me. The layout was working for me well. There's also, it looks like Mad Play uses this. Play uses this. Play is from the Socks package. Rec from Socks. I think Play and Rec. Yeah, that's from Socks, I think. And Socks itself. So, and Socks I all use lib ID3 tag to detect metadata in MP3 files and whatever else uses ID3, and then they're able to report it back to you. libIDL is the Interface Definition Language library, which is used within CORBA, CORBA, and it's used by SeaMonkey and the Mozilla suite. Well, SeaMonkey itself is the what they call what they are developing, and it is an active project. You can go to seamonkey-project.org, and they've got news from like September 20, 2023. So, it's still happening. What is it? It's a community effort to develop the SeaMonkey Internet Application Suite, and that's what they're calling it. And what that is what Netscape used to be, and later Mozilla used to be. And that means that it has an internet browser, it has your email, your email client, your news group client, a web feed reader, HTML editor. So if you're one of those people who just you do not like to write your own HTML code, you want like a something to help you with that. SeaMonkey actually has a pretty good sort of like HTML editor within it that you can use to kind of make that process a little bit easier. IRC chat, web development tools, all kinds of little things that you would need for the internet. And it uses source code from Firefox and Thunderbird. So it's kind of adjacent, I guess, to a lot of what Mozilla does. It is included on Slackware, which is probably why libIDL is included. But why is libIDL? Why does it exist? Well, to understand why libIDL exists, you need to know what CORBA is. And in order to understand what CORBA is, you need to know what ORB is. So ORB is the or and ORBIT, I think, is Object Request Broker. That's what that is, an Object Request Broker. What's that? Well, when an application written in one language wants to communicate with an application written in some other language, they need to know where they can connect, like what's available from one to the other. This mapping is defined in an Interface Definition Language file, that's IDL, which again, libIDL, so there you go, that's the Interface Definition Language. This is used by CORBA, the Common Object Request Broker architecture, to enable different systems that have been built, differently from one another, to essentially have the right ports and jacks to connect to one another, more or less. It's probably not a very good definition, and that's partly because I've never used it before. I'm speaking entirely from sort of reverse engineering, otherwise known as reading the documentation. And honestly, one of the best documentations on this comes from Wikipedia. If you go to wikipedia.org and look for CORBA, or Common Underscore Object Underscore Request Underscore Broker Underscore Architecture, then it's a surprisingly lucid explanation of what all of this stuff is. And I don't mean it's surprising because like I don't expect that from Wikipedia. This is a really sort of niche topic that libidl, GNOME's documentation about Corba, they don't explain it, I think, as well as this Wikipedia page. I don't know how, I mean, Corba is kind of was phased out from GNOME as far as I know, but I guess maybe some of the GTK stuff still kind of like uses it, maybe. I'm not sure why CMonkey is still using this, or maybe libidl is useful for stuff outside of Corba, or maybe something, maybe the new Corba is close enough. I'm not sure. I don't know the status of this because I don't use it. But there you go. That's what it is. That's a horrible one to end on just because I feel a little bit fuzzy about what it even is. Like, I can't really picture it in my head. So let's talk about something that's a lot easier to picture. This is libidn, which I know doesn't really sound like it's going to be that great, but that's the Internationalized Domain Name Library. And you can almost kind of imagine what that is from its name, Internationalized Domain Names. So the internet, as you may or may not know, uses domain names. We use those domain names because they're easier to remember than IP addresses. But the kind of the problem is, people realized pretty early on, like I think back in 87, pretty early on, people realized, wait a minute, the internet is starting to be more than just like a cross state, you know, something in the US where there was the government network and the university networks and eventually all those, and I think the military one, you know, or maybe that's the government one, I don't know, but whatever, all those networks that sort of came together to form the start of the internet and then started becoming more global and stuff like that. At some point, people realized, well, it doesn't scale to have hard coded all of our domain names as ASCII text, because someone over in Germany, like Matthias, is going to want to use that funny looking B letter, that the double S, you know, the capital B looking thing. I forget the name of that character, and probably couldn't say it if I knew it, in their domain name. Or someone in Greece is going to want to type in, you know, their natural, the thing that their keyboard types in. So we needed a way to translate domain names that people are going to use natively, you know, in their own language. We needed something to translate that to ASCII so that the DNS servers could recognize it. What's the easiest way to do that outside of overhauling everything to use Unicode, like back in 1987 or whenever this thing was written? It was a lot earlier than you might think. Like this happened really early. I'm trying to find the date that I saw. I'm not seeing it, but anyway, it happened earlier than you think it would have happened. So outside of like just, yeah, making everyone, yeah, no, 1987, and then implemented in 1990. So the easy way to do that was just to write a library that took the input of something that's not ASCII text and translate it to something that is ASCII text. And I mean, As far as I know, that doesn't have to be very complex. And I have not made a study of this, but for instance, in Esperanto, bear with me. In Esperanto, you have certain letters that have macrons over them. I think they're macrons, whatever those little lines are. I don't think those are macrons, actually. And one of the ways that people, like if you don't know how to make a line over a letter, or if there's an input system that doesn't accept that, then there's a shortcut or a variation that you can do such that you just type the letter that you would normally put a line over and then the letter X right after it. And everyone knows that when there's a letter followed by an X like that means, oh, that's actually just putting a line over it. Now, as Unicode becomes more popular, that is, I think, less common and less necessary, but it's something that might still be used. In Māori, for instance, in New Zealand, you've got the letters over you've got the lines over certain letters, like the A and the E and the I and the O, I think. And again, if you don't have access to that A symbol or the line symbol, then when typing something that normally would have a line over it, some people just double the letter. You wouldn't normally spell Mori as M-A-A-O-R-I, for instance, but if you were stuck with ASCII text, then that's a shorthand, and everyone knows, well, you wouldn't see double letters like that in Mori normally, so you just sort of, in your head, translate that double letter to a single letter with the line over it. So, and I think that's basically kind of what libidn does as well. I mean, neither of those two examples are taken from libidn. They're just things that I've encountered as I mess around with languages that I don't know. But the libidn, I mean, it doesn't have to do anything human friendly. It can be pretty strict. It can stay pretty strictly tied to computing. Like, it doesn't. That's all it's used for, is for the translation of internationalized domain names to something that DNS can understand. And I don't know, maybe we're working on making this translation step unnecessary. I don't know the status of that. I think it would be nice. But, I mean, that Unicode conversion, man, boy, it's taken a while. And, anyway, that's libidn. It's just there. It just works. It's doing its thing in the background. We don't have to think about it. And that's such a great thing. That's so cool. And it's open source and it's available for anything. So, you know, like, it doesn't, you just never have to think about it. And we'll stop there. We're not through the eyes, but we got pretty far along in the eyes. We breezed past whatever we started in. What, G, I think? That's not bad. That's pretty good. And we'll just keep going. Next episode. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.